AmericansForTheArts.org.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We have a pretty exciting program planned for you today. But before we start that, I want to remind you, did you know that WMNF accepts gifts of stock? It's a great way to make a tax deduction donation to your station and a big difference to your community. To find out how to donate stocks and get a tax break, call Jean Moore at 813-238-8001. Please make any donation by December 31st, and thanks. And so, where are we going from here, Mary?
Well, yes, we have a very full show planned. But, you know, something happened on the way driving down today. Because, yes, on the show today, we're going to be dealing, number one, with the threats to net neutrality. There are trillions to be made out there by internet service providers, and when they're only making billions, they want the trillions. And so that's directly under challenge, going to be voted on December 14th, so it's coming right up. And then we're going to be talking about tax reform, or just call it what it is, tax heist, if you will. And we just heard the news. Another man has apologized for his behavior. He's sorry for his behavior. What does he think about the people he victimized? But, you know, when did we become the nation we have become? We have become a pretty bad place, to tell you the truth. So I was driving, and I noticed this woman yesterday, and she had a sign. She was hungry. And it happened to be that when I saw her, it was a green light, because anytime I see a woman that's out asking for money, I will try my best to get to her and give it to her, because I know how tough it is for anybody that's out, whether they're homeless or very marginal, and have to go and solicit on the street, so to speak. But particularly a woman, I really worry about women. And so today, luckily, I had a red light, and so I was able to give her some money. And so she is so bone thin, honestly. She's certainly over 100 pounds, and she's probably about 5'8". And I think actually she's under 90 pounds. And so I told her, I said, could you please try and eat more? Oh, she said, honey, she said, I've got Crohn's disease, and no matter what I eat, I can't keep it down. Now, Crohn's disease is an inflammation of the large intestine. It's not a good disease to have. It's hard to manage, and it requires good medical attention. And here, this is right outside, huge medical areas at USF and very near community hospital. And there, this woman, I looked at her a little closer, and she looked like she'd be 60s or 70s, but I'm sure she's not. I'm sure she's maybe in her mid-40s to early 50s. And I really was feeling bad, because that woman would have a rough time keeping a job. The nature of Crohn's disease is such that it's hard to manage. They get flare-ups, and sometimes just really bad weather can cause flare-ups. And there, you know, we've got the tax heist that's trying to get through, and they're trying to get rid of the mandate. They're trying to get rid of chips. And there is a woman literally dying on the streets of Tampa, who should not be dying, in the wealthiest country in the world. And we are being absolutely gouged for our medical care, which is inadequate. It's not available. It's pay as you can go. And I wonder, when did we become so mean? This kind of a nation, in my opinion, this is not the America that I have always loved and believed in. And I think that still the heart of America is there. But I don't know. Anyway, I'm just going to play this little music before Eliza Gilkison, and then we will get into the rest of our show.
Many years ago, he looked out through a glassless window. All that he could see was Babylon. Beautiful green fields and dreams. He learned to measure the stars, but there was a worry in his heart. He said, how could it come to this? I'm really worried about living. How could it come to this? Yeah.
This down, this great, great song by Eliza Gilkeson, one of our real treasures, I think, singer-songwriter. Anyway, but also, yes, going into net neutrality, to my opinion, it's the nervous system of the world. And if you're going to affect the communication of all of us, you know, not just with our colleagues, but literally across the world, it's really being challenged. And the FCC is going to be voting December 14th. So I was able to catch up with Corinne McShelley. She's the legal director of Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so she is going to be explaining net neutrality to us. And so, Corinne McSherry. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Corinne McSherry, and she is a legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and many times EFF.org. And she is going to be talking to us about, I think, the bravest challenge to the internet in the most important area, net neutrality. So, Corinne, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, IGPA is back at it again. After Barack Obama's administrations, you know, we thought we had net neutrality solved for a while, but apparently that's not the case. And so what is he hoping to do with his, is it Title II of the Federal Communications Act? What is he trying to do with net neutrality?
Well, so he's trying to do what actually no FCC chairman of either party has ever done, which is scrap net neutrality rules altogether. So for more than a decade, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, we've had the FCC in various ways trying to impose regulations on internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, basically the people that you use to access the internet. They provide you kind of the basic infrastructure, to impose rules on them to make sure that they are letting the content pass through their pipes down to subscribers in a fair way. So every FCC chairman has agreed that that was a good idea until now. And the new FCC, under Chairman Pai's leadership, with a Republican majority, but again, this isn't a partisan issue, to be honest, but the new group has decided that we don't need any rules at all. Basically, the only rule that we're going to have is that the ISPs have to be transparent about their practices. But as long as they're honest about it, put it up on, say, a website or in their terms of service, that's good enough.
Are they really seriously saying that? I mean, after all we're following with Facebook and everything else, rule ourselves. And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and I've seen this referred to, that net neutrality, you might say, is the First Amendment of the Internet world and the kind of communication, almost nervous system to the world that we have had. And when you say it's not partisan, isn't something like 98.5% of the American population in favor of net neutrality?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you look at what the public wants, the public does not want this. And lots of small service providers don't want this. Lots and lots of small businesses don't want this. I mean, it's kind of the FCC is supposed to serve the public interest, but is really going forward and saying, we don't care what the public thinks about anything. We don't care about the evidence. I mean, because this shouldn't be just a matter of public opinion. It should be a matter of looking at the evidence and looking what you need to do and what you don't need to do. So lots and lots of organizations, including my own EFF, submitted comments in the record to say this is why we need net neutrality with detailed evidence and facts and so on. And this proposal ignores all of that in favor of basically the evidence that was submitted by the ISPs, which is, let's face it, not neutral. Right, it's obviously, you know, they're sort of biased submissions. They're claiming that they won't invest as much in the Internet if they have to follow net neutrality rules. But the irony is, at the exact same time, they are also saying, we promise to follow net neutrality rules voluntarily. We just don't want to be regulated. So you kind of have to wonder what's going on here, because if you don't mind the rules, mostly, then why don't we just leave them in place?
Well, and as I understand it, and it's a very crude analogy, it's kind of like saying, you know, that you've got a telephone or you've got your iPhone, whatever. And so you know, it's a communication service, so to speak. In other words, you use this, but it has no right to interfere whatever of the content or what you're going to be saying on your phone or what you choose to, you know, peruse on that phone with your Internet. And so they want to be actually, rather than just a communications provider, they want to be information provider.
Well, what they want to be able to do mostly is something called paid prioritization. And the catchphrase for it is basically they want to create internet fast lanes. And what this means, very simply, is they want to be able to make sure that some content reaches you faster, loads a little bit faster than other content. So, for example, if you choose Comcast's own video streaming service, that's going to be nice and smooth and a good user experience for you, as opposed to, say, some alternative streaming service that maybe provides alternative content or whatever is simply independent of Comcast. Your experience using that service may not be quite as good, and you won't realize it's because the internet service provider is basically interfering and has relegated that other service to the slow lane and prioritized its own service for the fast lane. And it's not just about video. I mean, we often use video as an example because everybody loves their Netflix, but we're actually talking about something that's much more basic, and this is why we talk about net neutrality as the First Amendment of the Internet. It's that we're talking about relegating, you know, basic services, access to educational sites, government sites, libraries, healthcare information, all of these things that we rely on the Internet to access these days. All of that may be relegated to these kind of slow lanes and load more slowly and just be more difficult to get to, as opposed to, you know, the content that the ISPs want to favor. And just one last point on this is there's a kind of even more fundamental problem to my mind, which is that up until now, ISPs have, for the most part, folks like Comcast and Verizon, they've just been infrastructure, right? They just lay out the infrastructure, and they make lots and lots of money. They are incredibly profitable in providing that internet access to you. But now there'll be something that we haven't had on the internet before, which is gatekeepers. They want to put themselves in a position where if I want to reach out to a Comcast subscriber or a group of subscribers, I need to go to Comcast and make a deal with them to make sure that my reach to those subscribers is going to be high quality. I've never had to do that before, right? Till now, the way the internet works, if I build a website or a service or whatever, I put it out there. If users like it, great, they can access it. This is going to change all that.
Yeah, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's the ball game, and you know I'm comparing it, you know, to my cable service in our area. You know, pretty Tampa Bay region is a pretty big region. We have a very small selection actually of cable companies, and I'm stuck with the basic programs they have. You know, and if I want to get some of the extra channels that I might want, I've got to pay more. And also many areas, even in our area, only have one provider. And to me, what does that do to, you know, improve my use of my internet?
Well, I think that that's pretty fundamental. The fact that most people don't have a choice, or they have very limited choices. And because really, if we had competition in this space, then we might not need regulations. Because, you know, you could vote with your wallet, basically. You could say, I'm going to go to this other provider, and I don't like what the one ISP is offering, so I'm going to go to this other person and who I think treats me a little bit better. We don't have that. We don't have that at all. And so in most areas of the country. And so, you know, it's precisely in these kinds of situations when you need regulation. I mean, because, you know, frankly, many people are suspicious of government regulation coming in because they worry that they won't do a good job. And I understand that. I actually am very sympathetic with that viewpoint. But this is one of the exceptions. When you have a world in which you have virtual monopolies, that's actually when you really do need those public interest protections to come in because the market's not going to take care of it.
Yeah, no, you know, who are you going to trust, the government or the markets? I mean, at least with governments, you do have some say. I'm sorry, but with an IPS market, I don't hear my voice being heard. If 98.5% of the American people are very much in favor of net neutrality, and just a couple years ago, you know, when they fought it out, millions and millions of people, you know, made their views known one way or another. I'd rather have the government doing some regulations than this group.
Well, I think that that's right. I mean, I think that one of the things that is particularly frustrating about all of this is the fact that so many people have spoken up from so many, you know, just ordinary internet users, but also, you know, much more sophisticated entities, and said, we want net neutrality. Please don't abandon these protections. It's sort of like, you know, we talked a lot about with healthcare and repeal and replace. We should have repeal. There is no replace. And people have said, please don't do this. And it strikes me as tremendously arrogant that the FCC, the majority of the FCC, has decided to simply ignore all that altogether. Their view is, you people don't understand how the internet works. Leave it to us. We'll make this decision for you, and we will just ignore all that input. I mean, public agencies actually aren't supposed to ignore public input. They're supposed to solicit it, which they did, but they're also supposed to pay attention to it, right? So all of us that went and filed comments, it kind of feels like, was that just a waste of time? Because apparently you guys actually don't feel that you need to respond. And, you know, to the extent that there was a response in the proposal, it's basically to the effect of, we think you just don't really understand. So we're just going to go ahead and make our decision anyway.
Yeah, the hubris. And I guess they just think they own the airwaves and that we have no clue how much money they can make out of this by selling all of our data and making us pay more to figure out who we need to get in contact with. You know, to me, is it their airwaves? Are they going to be a communication just provider of the infrastructure? Or are they going to control the whole shebang? And to me, I think, you know, to me, this is the internet. To me, is kind of the nervous system of the world, and this, to me, this is really huge. So, what can people do?
Well, there's a few things that people can do. So that's very important. So one of the things that they can do right now is they can go to EFF.org, and we have an action center there, and they can take advantage of it. It's right on the front of our website. You'll see a link about net neutrality. You can go ahead, learn more, and also take action to contact Congress. The other thing that you should do immediately is go to battleforthenet.com. And they have a call tool, and so you should actually call Congress, because right now this is an important time to really hop on the phone. We've actually managed to drive something like 200,000 phone calls to Congress over the last few weeks on this exact issue, which is a really tremendous number. So they need to keep hearing from us that, and telling Congress over and over, the public does not want this. Tell Chairman Pai to stop the vote. Because the vote on this new proposal is scheduled for the 14th of December. So we have basically 2.5 weeks to stop it. There was a time when I would have thought that was impossible, but having been involved in some pretty heavy-duty internet activism over the past decade, I have been impressed over and over with what internet users can accomplish when they want to. We have stopped some very, very dangerous legislation, and we also got these net neutrality rules adopted in the first place just a couple of years ago. So I think we can do it, but everybody has to be motivated and activated.
Well, Corinne McTerry, I certainly hope you're right, and all you activists out there, all you people that depend on the internet, heed her advice. Go to their website and click on and immediately get involved. So, and again, their website's very easy, EFF.org. And that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, Corinne McSherry, thank you so much for giving us this time today. We did this pretty quickly. Anything you particularly wanted to mention we didn't get out?
No, I'm really glad that you asked me that last question. That was just the thing.
Okay, thank you so much, and you do take care.
And again,
Corinne McSherry, and it's EFF, electronicfrontierfoundation.org. They've just got oodles of information. If you want more understanding of net neutrality, et cetera, you'll find it there. It's a wonderful website. Arlene?
I posted one of the latest articles by Sherry on our website from a woman's point of view.
You mean McSherry?
McSherry. Corinne McSherry. Yes, sorry.
Irish background there. Okay, well, you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Yes, we've got to do this, people.
Tuesday. Hey, Mr. Telecom Man, God save the internet. Don't change my reality. Keep net neutrality. Tell about a take a year. Shout it out and hope someone hears. Or just ignore it and drink a beer. Don't believe the hype, don't buy the fear. She's a terrible mother, that Britney Spears. Must we remind you, it's election year.
Jill Sobel and her friends trying, and that actually was put out a couple of years ago in the battle. We thought we had pretty much established the importance of net neutrality, but, and the courts and so many backed it up, but anyway, it's under pressure again. Okay, and again, you are listening to WMF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, and now on to the tax heist. And so I was able to catch up actually Monday, and quite a bit has happened since then, but that was when he was available. So let's listen to Robert Borisage, and he's going to be talking about the tax reform. Well, I am so happy to welcome to the show Robert Borisage, and he is an activist, a writer personified. He's a contributing editor to The Nation. He is the founder of Campaign for America's Future. You can also pick up his writings in the New York Times and other articles. He also was, I believe, with the Institute for Policy Studies for like 10 years. And so, Robert Borisage, welcome so much to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, yeah, I hope people have been reading your articles. They can catch them on The Nation, or they can catch them on your website, americasfuture.org, because I think your latest article, in my opinion, really nails it when you said that you think that they're trying to destroy government, these new, quotes, tax reforms, and they must think we're a bunch of idiots. Because practically no one could possibly approve of these unless you're in that uber wealthy.
Well, I think that's right. And what's interesting is Americans aren't falling for it. So this is one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation, according to the polls, that we've seen, even more unpopular at this point than their attempt to repeal Obamacare. Voters are in polling 2-1 against this tax cut, and most sensibly understand that they aren't going to benefit from it.
You know, I think I was fascinated, though, and kind of troubled that when I think it was in one of your articles that I read, that in spite of that, like they divide into a third, the third feels they might improve a little bit, third feels it'll be worse for them, and a third about the same. But in spite of that, it was a 44% that they thought actually that this would improve the economy.
Yeah, well, that's the great myth that Republicans are trying to sell, which is the old trickle-down theory, which George Bush once called voodoo economics, that if you cut taxes on the rich and on the corporations, it will generate massive growth, etc. What's interesting about this moment, unlike the time when Reagan did it, it didn't work under Reagan, it didn't work under Bush, too, George W. Bush. But what's interesting about this time is, unlike those two occasions, there really isn't any economic modeling, right, left, or center, except for the most extreme corrupted right-wing models that suggest that this will produce growth. And the reason for that is quite simple. The corporations already have record profits. And if they were going to invest, they would be investing already. The rich already have more money than they've ever had since, a higher percentage of greater inequality than we've seen since 1929. So giving the rich more money and the corporations more money is not going to create any kind of growth whatsoever. Goldman Sachs, a conservative pro-Wall Street bank, which is not exactly a progressive institution, really suggests that maybe you get 0.5% increase in growth, which is basically saying they don't think there's going to make much change on the economy. So that's the great myth they're trying to justify this thing with. Meanwhile, they've created a tax plan which is truly perverse. By 2027, the most independent analysis shows fully 62% of all the value of the tax cuts goes to the top 1%, who are captured more of our income and wealth than ever since 1929 and the eve of the Great Depression. So this is preposterous. And the problem is you're taking $1.4 trillion out of the out of revenue, and that is money we desperately need for vital public investments, which would in fact create jobs and growth. That is, there isn't anyone, there's no analyst of America that doesn't understand that our roads are in miserable shape, our bridges are decrepit, our mass transit is slow and inadequate, our airports are aged and overcrowded, our water systems are dangerous, we have 40, 50-year-old pipes that are starting to collapse. We've got to rebuild an infrastructure that was basically built after World War II under Eisenhower. And we've got to put real money into doing that. And when you do that, you create jobs, you put people to work, you make the economy much more efficient for business and much more pleasant for people. And to instead decide, no, we're not going to put that money into rebuilding America. We're going to put it into the pockets of the rich and the corporations who already have more money than they need. It's just really a truly preposterous decision. And that's what Republicans are intent on doing without a Democratic vote and trying to drive it through the Senate and the House in less than 2 weeks.
Well, and, you know, Robert, I have been following, I have no idea really what our economy is anymore, because to me, you know, and you've just written wonderfully about this, you know, how they store their profits offshore and whether those are foreign profits or American profits. And that's a very big part that Trump says, oh, we're going to tax that and that's going to just take care of everything. But, you know, the kind of almost draconian measures that these lawyers or whoever come up with ways for them not to pay their fair share and to stack their loot, etc. To me, they're also using that same kind of draconian, really kind of mathematics, if you will, to screw people here in this country even more. And so I'm going to your article on destroying government and the stuff you just named, you know, the roads, our bridges, and it's horrifying. Some of the statistics about our bridges, how many are failing each day, the shape they're in. And we all know our potholes, et cetera. But we're looking at things like the future of a country is also education, it's health. And in this tax bill, they are just creaming that totally. And I, you know, the, to me, you know, that all this money has become not just shadow money, that it is the power of this nation. And it's become all about this kind of gamesmanship. And so the real business of a country and a government is not being addressed at all.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. You know, there's a difference, I think, that's taken place because of the structural change of the economy. It used to be that businessmen, the head of General Motors, the auto industry, et cetera, understood they had a real stake in a middle class that could buy their cars, interstate highways and good roads on which their cars could travel, et cetera. And while they were still conservative and they still wanted tax breaks, they understood the need to build a basic infrastructure in America. Now, as the corporations have gone global, and they earn their profits abroad, or they earn their profits here, and they book them abroad and refuse to pay taxes on them. And the CEOs have a next quarter mentality, which is you have many CEOs really just essentially milking their companies, selling off parts, laying off workers, merging, purging, in order to keep the stock price up over the next quarter so their bonuses stay up, and then they leave. And what you've got is a capitalism now, and a capitalist elite, which no longer has a shared interest in not simply most Americans, but in even rebuilding the sinews needed to have a strong basis for a really advanced economy. And you're right, that includes not only physical infrastructure, it includes investments in education, in science and technology, in health and research, and all of the things that are vital to an advanced society. You can't sustain an advanced economy if you're not making public investments in areas that will keep us on the cutting edge of new inventions, etc. And what this bill does is it just guarantees we are already under Republican budgets, slashing science and technology, slashing investment in health research. And this budget goes after education in a way that's truly unconscionable. graduate students are learning that they're going to pay tax increases as much as 40% hikes in taxes, because they're not going to allow them, they're going to charge them essentially for the tuitions that are forgiven when they do work-study programs. The interest on student loans, which are in themselves a scandal, will no longer be tax-deductible. Even school teachers who get a paltry tax cut of $250 for the supplies they buy out of their pockets for their classrooms, even that tax deduction is eliminated in order that we can give the top 1%, 62% of the benefits of this supposed tax cut. It is really an extraordinary set of decisions that really I don't think it's partisan in that sense. I don't think there's many Republicans across the country, if they sat down and looked at this thing, would think this is a set of rational decisions.
So
it just doesn't make sense.
So why then are they supporting it? That's the House, and we know that they want to have a vote before Christmas. After all, that's going to be our lump of coal from Scrooge. Why are they so supporting it?
Well, I think many Republicans have been remarkably candid. Lindsey Graham said, if we don't pass this, the donors will no longer take our calls. The leader of the House Ways and Means Committee says we have no choice but to tax this if we want to continue to raise money for our campaigns. The Texas congressman said, my donors say pass this or don't give me a phone call. It's quite clear there's a lot of very wealthy people who are going to benefit enormously from this tax bill, who are the donors to these campaigns and who Republicans have promised tax cuts to, and now they're standing in and collecting. You know, if you're in the top 0.1%, 0.1%, 0.1% of America, and you're making over $1 million a year, you're going to get a $200,000 tax cut a year. This is great stuff for you, right?
Yeah, and
if you make $75,000 or less, at the end of by 2027, you're going to face your taxes going up, which no one really knows, but is true because of all of the deductions that they've got in the beginning. They end in about 2025 in the Senate bill, and people will face rising taxes, not a tax cut if they make less than $75,000. A year.
Yeah, and the Senate bill wants to increase the taxes for $10,000 to $75,000. I mean, again, I find this just draconian. And if I could go back, and again, we're talking to Robert Borisaj, and you can catch his writing, and really, I would strongly suggest you do, because he writes very well, and you can understand it if you aren't an economist, like most of us aren't, and you can see why he founded the Campaign for America's Future. You know, I think one of the things that really troubles me the most is this money game, if you will. And you know, the corporations, you know, that I thought it was kind of appalling when you and some others pointed out the statistics that, you know, they don't even invest any of their profits, you know, in building their industry. Quite the opposite. You know, that they use it to buy back their own stocks and bonds to up the price then of their stocks. And then they, being the CEO, they're going to make a bundle. And it is so in your face, you know, that this is only about money, which translates, obviously, to them to such power. I think it's just appalling.
Well, it is appalling, and this, of course, is the great betrayal of Donald Trump, because in a sense, he ran on a promise to clean the swamp out. He ran on a promise that he was rich enough, he would be independent. He promised this tax cut wouldn't give a tax cut for the rich, that it would be a tax cut for working people who needed the money to help them meet daily bills. All of those turn out to be lies. And even on the signature Trump program, which is supposedly to be on trade and getting jobs abroad, this tax bill increases the ability of corporations to report profits abroad, increases the incentive to move jobs abroad in order to get a permanent tax break and pay less taxes than they pay if they're domestic companies doing business here in America.
You know, in a way, Robert, I'm almost kind of glad that Trump is so completely over the top. I mean, there's nothing subtle about it. I mean, it is there, really obvious. I think, to me, Americans have always had kind of a love affair with a truly uber wealthy person. Somehow, I think that all of us kind of want to get rich, and we like to think we're so independent and free and all this stuff, and no one's going to tell us what to do. Yet, we want our fire departments, we want our police, we want our hospitals, we want our schools, and so we also realize this is part of it. But I think with Trump, I mean, he is so glaringly, to me, almost the archetype type of this kind of person, that it's maybe a good thing that his personality is right out there up front.
Well, yes and no. That is, yes, I think it's important people understand the betrayal of the promises that he made when he campaigned. But it's also important to recognize this is driven by a unified Republican caucus in the House and the Senate. They can't pass this bill, which is this ridiculous, except for the fact that they have in the House all but 13 Republicans voting for it, and a majority then of the House. And in the Senate, they can't lose. They can only lose two votes. If they lose three Republicans, they can't pass this bill. And so this is a unified position of the Republican Congress now on a bill that is true folly for the country and is preposterous in its specific terms.
And I'm going to go back a minute, because to me, some of the most important areas really are education, health, et cetera. And you were talking about education, and I think what they're doing, you know, to me, almost to make higher education inaccessible for the average person. And did I read correctly that actually the student college debt is higher than the credit card debt now?
Yes, it is. It's the second, it's just behind home mortgages as the source of family debt now.
And
it's higher than credit card debt.
And you can't.
$1 trillion.
And anyone would know, you can't have that kind of creativity and imagination, which you really particularly need for the young. I'm sorry, if you're burdened with that kind of debt, that I was reading about this one woman who's like 63 or 64, and she says she can't afford to retire because she still hasn't paid off her college loans. And I mean, this is America. And then also, you know, with CHIPS and getting rid of the pre-K and the cuts they have for Medicare, I mean, these are in the bill right now.
Right. The bill mandates, because of the Senate rules for paying as you go, it mandates an immediate $25 billion cut in Medicare. The Republican budget over the next 5 years calls for a $1 trillion cut in Medicaid and a $500 billion cut in Medicare. And it calls for really decimating the investments we make in public education, in the environment, in public parks, in any public function, really. And that's required by the budget rules under which the Congress operates if you're going to pass a tax bill that gives $1.4 trillion basically to corporations and the rich.
Yeah, and I know people are really, really upset. And so, and I know one of the most important things, you know, for our listeners, they're activists. What can they do? I know call the representatives, et cetera, but what can they be doing to put the kind of pressure that actually they put on for the ACA, you know, when they tried to withdraw that? And, of course, that's also, were you a little surprised when the Senate put that in their bill?
They put the
taking away the mandate.
Removing the mandate from to buy health care, which does two things. One, it guarantees that lower wage people pay more out of this bill. They don't get as many benefits as they used to. And for anybody who's getting their health care through the exchanges, they're going to face price increases that are estimated to be about 10% because they've removed the mandate. And 13 million people, an estimated 13 million people, will lose health care coverage completely, choose not to have health care because they won't be able to afford it. That's part of the bill. I think that's the thing that's the hardest for people to wrap their minds around, which is, this is not just, oh, they're going to give a lot of money to the rich and maybe I'll get a little bit. This is, they're going to give a lot of money to the rich and the corporations, and they're going to do deep, draconian cuts in basic public investments that no advanced economy can do without, in public schools, in science, in technology, in the environment. You know, we've got to make an investment in renewable energy and in creating a different kind of electric grid, and all of that is sacrificed if you pass this kind of, if you hand out this kind of a benefit to the very few and to the corporations. So they're making a set of choices that, you know, can only be made if you're in an ideological extreme position that suggests government, you know, ought to be so small we can, as Grover Norquist, the right-wing activist, put it, we can drown it in a bathtub. And we, all we need is an economy that the rich and the corporations drive, and we'll have no problem. And it simply ignores that all of the public functions that corporations and people depend on, from public schools to public roads to sewers that work to water systems that don't poison you. That's all that is put at risk when you start handing, at this point in time, when we've starved public investment for the last decades, now you're going to make it even worse.
Yeah, it is so draconian, really. I'm sure they spent hours or years probably going through the disabled, and people have been long-term employed, the kind of tax breaks that they would give, you know, to make these jobs accessible, et cetera, the veterans. It's just across the board. Anything that government has done to try and help people that did need some help, but also for the benefits of the entire society, they have been pared down, because then they can give a semblance, you know, that they have, quotes, this, the balance. But even they are saying that, oh, we've got to have these tax cuts, and, you know, because we've got to grow our economy, even the deficit does grow a little bit. But we've played this game over and over and over again. The Republicans somehow have this, you know, reputation that they're so conservative, you know, and they do so well. Well, they build up the deficits. A Democrat comes in. He has to spend all kinds of time, you know, to try and pare this down and make it manageable again. And then, boom, the same cycle or bust. But this is almost, to me, going for the whole enchilada, because I can't see, with this kind of a deficit, and a deficit of everything we've got in the society, not just but money, but as you said, our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our sewers, you know, our pipes, our water. Flint isn't the only state city that's suffering. This, to me, is almost a whole enchilada, and I just don't know how this country or any country could take this kind of a hit and hope to really keep functioning for people in this society.
Well, I think that's right. I think we will end, if we pass this bill, we will end 5 years, 10 years from now with a less efficient, more decrepit infrastructure, with less opportunity, with people carrying greater burdens, whether it's student debt or the cost they'll have to pay for health care, which will be higher. This bill will make a difference in people's lives, and it will not be the $36 they're supposed to get as a tax cut in the first year. It will be all the costs that they bear over the next years and that impinge on their daily lives. Let me just say one thing about the thoughtfulness, though. You know, Republicans started out, they wanted to do a big tax cut for the corporations. And the theory was they were going to close loopholes in the corporate tax cut and then lower the top rate. Well, they lowered the top rate, but they didn't close the loopholes. So then they had to find other places to pay for the tax cuts, and that turned to individuals and to various tax deductions that people use. And so that's why the teacher's tax deduction got cut. That's why the tax deduction that goes to businesses that hire the disabled got cut. That's why you went through this process, and they still, of course, ended up $400 billion short over 10 years, and just added that to the deficit. But the thing about this is, it wasn't a thoughtful process. This was done without public hearings, in closed meetings, in a rush in this last year, desperate to pass it by the end of the year for no reason other than political politics. that they wanted to say they got something done. And so it's not like this has been a thoughtful, deliberative process that chose the best targeted, streamlined eliminations of deductions that made sense. This has been a predator's raid on the Treasury by the richest and the biggest corporations, and the Republicans cobbling together what they could to try to make the math work so that the deficit would only be an increase of $1.4 trillion rather than even more. So even there's this kind of wonderful promise of a tax break for pass-through businesses, which are supposed to be, you know, the small businesses that are mom-and-pop stores, etc. That tax deduction in the Senate bill is eliminated in 2025. Mm-hmm. So these are illusions. This is cobbled together in the last minute under great pressure that they put on themselves because of politics and because of the need to meet the demands of their donors to get the tax cut passed this year while they've still got their majorities and before they head into an election season where voters are going to take a good look at what they've done.
Well, okay, Robert Borsod's contributing editor at The Nation and founder of the Campaign for America's Future. Most important thing, what can people do?
Well, there isn't much substitute except making certain that your voices are heard by your legislators. That means not just calling, but showing up at their local offices. It means writing them. It means making certain that the people they know in your community know how upset you are. There's a kind of, Washington has this sort of bubble where communications are filtered through the offices, and it's easy for legislators to ignore them. But when they feel pressure in their local offices, when people show up with, you know, in mass, in large numbers, as we did in town meetings, et cetera, and if they're not having town meetings simply at their local office to make their objections heard, they start to get worried. And it's particularly true if it's the people who are traditionally their supporters. So if you're a Democrat and you know Republicans, you ought to be getting them to think through the implications of what their legislators are doing and not go along with the PAP. And if you're a Republican and you understand the implications of this bill, you ought to be making certain that your Republican legislators know about it. What's stunning about this vote, which is a major change in our tax code, is that at this point, there isn't a Democrat in the House or Senate who will vote for it. This is a pure partisan play from a very extreme position, headed towards doing real damage to the country.
Well, Robert Borsod, thank you so much for all the great work you've done and you're doing, and keep up the great work. Thanks so much for giving us this time today. I know how busy you are, so thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
And again, it's important, people. your future, I think the future of this country is at stake. Go ahead, Arlene.
Yes, and if you'd like to call your senators, and we urge you to do that, Senator Rubio's number is 202-224-3041, 202-224-3041, and Senator Nelson, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121. Of course, it's extremely important right now to call Republican senators, but also we need to make sure that our Democratic senators like Senator Nelson know that we appreciate their standing strong. Also want to alert you to an event that will be happening Saturday night, or Saturday, starting actually at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Doors open at 3. It is the third annual ukulele festival, Uke It Out. It's sponsored by the station, and it will be at Cage Brewing, 2001 First Avenue South in St. Petersburg. Tickets are $12 in advance, $15 at the door, and kids 12 and under are free. If you'd like to get tickets, you can call Miss Julie at 238-8001.
And you have been listening to WMNF 88.5 Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Just keep it here all day, people.
They got a